It's Carmen Wong Ulrich here, and this is your Marketplace Money podcast for the weekend of December 27th, 2013. So this show is about the choices you make in life and how to not only get more money out of those choices, but more value. This week in How We Live Money, we're going to look back at the year that was for your wallet. And are you in a rush to close out that mortgage? Not so fast. Also, breaking up with your planner can be hard to do. How to do it right. But first, are you already standing in line to make returns? Well, Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith joins us now to give us some of the inside scoop on making sure that you get your money back or get what you really want. Hi, Stacey.
Hi, Carmen.
What is going on with store return policies? Things are changing these days.
For a long time, stores were getting more relaxed because online companies had to have more relaxed return policies because people couldn't try things on and things like that. But now we've seen a couple of really high profile examples of companies who are making their return policies stricter. One is Bloomingdale's. They've introduced something called the B tag.
Oh, yes.
The B tag is sort of a prominently placed tag on the dress. I say dress because
yes, it's mostly dresses for holiday parties that are being returned.
Yes, because this whole policy was in response to something that people called wardrobing. You would buy a fancy dress, you would wear it to a party, you would return the dress after the party and get a full refund. So apparently this started happening so much, Bloomingdale's introduced the B tag. If the B tag gets cut off, you cannot return the dress. The other is REI. Now, REI was famous. You could return anything in any condition years after purchase with no receipt. They even became known as Rental Equipment Inc.
Oh, dear.
They apparently began to experience some profit loss because this was happening on such a large scale in some cases. So now you can only return something after a year.
You just mentioned the cost of it.
Yeah.
So now retailers are using the same technology they use to kind of get to you and get you to spend money to track how often you bring things back.
Most people are very reasonable about it, but there are some people known as serial returners who do this all the time. So what happens is if you return something that is noted in a database, so if you want to return something again, the store will look up in the database and look at your return record and possibly make the call of whether or not to accept something based on if this is something you do a lot or if this is something that you don't do all that much.
But a return policy is just another way of protecting yourself from cost, and a lot of folks want that, right?
Yes. In fact, we're increasingly seeing this as part of customer service of a store. Marshall Cohen, I spoke with him about this. He's the chief retail analyst for the NPD group. And he says more and more often, because of the internet and various other things, we are willing to pay a little more for return policies.
It's the third or fourth reason why they buy, or in some cases, why they didn't buy. The fact that it didn't have a hassle-free return policy was a reason why some consumers wouldn't buy the product.
And Cohen said a lot of retailers will be very open about charging a little more. Zappos is a great example because of their generous return policy, and people are ready to do that. And he had a funny example of why that is.
Think of shoes as an easy example. You buy the shoes, they look great in the store, you put them on, they feel comfortable, and something happens between the store and by the time you get home. Because when you wear them for the first time, they kill your feet. How did that happen? Something happens mysteriously.
It does happen
mysteriously, more like you actually walked in them. Now, there's two things that are really important when it comes to returns.
Yeah.
One, very traditional, receipts, and the other, something new, restocking.
Receipts, a lot of stores will have, even if you buy something in-store, will have the option of an emailed receipt. And that's a really good idea. You don't have to keep track of it. You're not going through your wallet. You don't have 1,000 things in your purse. And it just makes things so much simpler. Yes.
Restocking fees. These happen now more often, I think, than ever.
It's a relatively new charge. Amazon apparently charges a 20% restocking fee for items if they've returned after 30 days.
A lot of times this has to do with electronics too. So I always tell folks, listen, you got to make sure you know what the restocking fee is before you buy that new tablet. And also how we pay can change things in terms of the ease of your return.
I guess if you play with a credit card, it's pretty pretty easy to return things. But PayPal is sort of an increasingly popular way to pay for all kinds of things. And that can make it really, really hard to return things if you want to. Some stores like American Eagle will only give you in-store credit. They won't refund your money. Other stores like The Limited will not let you return something if you paid with PayPal.
Thank you so much, Stacey, for joining us.
Thank you, Carmen. Move some focus from the stores back to home, like our first caller today.
Carmen.
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 Carmen. Carmen, what's going on?
Luisa joins me from Chicago. She's a teacher. She's 28. Her husband's 27. They want to save money for the big buy, the home, but they have a big hurdle, student loans. Welcome to the show, Luisa.
Thanks for having me.
You are caught between the two things that most 20, 30-somethings and even 40-somethings are caught in these days, which is balancing the student loans with wanting to own a home.
Exactly.
So tell me a little bit about, Luisa, what situation you're in terms of the student loans.
All right. So I owe about $16,000 and my husband owes about $27,000. I am overpaying for all of my student loans by probably, I don't know, $100 each. And then my husband isn't. So what I'm really wondering is if in the long run, is it better for me to keep overpaying my student loans or take that money and put it in towards the down payment of a house?
Well, can I ask, what are the interest rates on your loans?
Well, see, that's the thing. On my loans, I have two at 6.8%, one at 6.55%, and then I have three smaller ones at 3.25%. My husband's loans are all at 6.5%.
So you guys are in a little bit of a pricey territory, because I'd love if these were below 6% are the best loans. Are they federal or private?
They're all federal.
And can I ask, do you teach in a public school?
Yes, I do.
So did you know that your student loans, if they are federal and you are teaching for a qualifying public institution or you work for a qualifying public institution, that those loans can be forgiven?
After 10 years.
Exactly. So it does take 10 years. How many more years do you have according to your current schedule?
According to what I'm paying, I will pay my loans off in about 4 years. He will be taking about 8.
And how long have you been working at the school?
2 years.
Okay. So you could pay it off before schedule. You guys, with your income, seem to be at a point where you could qualify for a Roth IRA.
Yes, and my husband does have one through work, he has a 403B, mm-hmm. And his company matches up to 10%, which is what he's putting up, which is ridiculously crazy high. So we just took advantage of that.
That's
right away.
Fantastic, actually. Wow. Wow. But to clarify, a 403B is not a Roth IRA. So a 403B is like a 401K. So this is pre-tax money. A 403B is for public employers, and that's pre-tax money. A Roth, and the reason why I mention a Roth is that in 5 years that you have a Roth, you can withdraw the principal, the money that you originally put in, without penalty or taxes. But during those 5 years, it's growing tax-free.
Oh, so I could take that principal and use it towards a house because we don't have any fees to pay.
Exactly. It lets your money sit there and grow tax-free rather than in a savings account where even if you earn 1% interest, you're going to pay taxes on that 1% interest. And every little bit helps. The only thing is that your money will be locked up for 5 years. But you're saying you want this house much more quickly. How much money do you need to save to get the home?
Well, our goal is to save $25,000 just so we can start looking around. We want a house before we have kids, and I am feeling like I want kids sooner rather than later. So that's why we want the house as soon as we can afford it. Not as soon as possible, as soon as we can afford it.
And so what about how much money could you put aside? Well, first of all, how much do you have now saved up?
We have about $4,500 saved up between just our regular savings and our, we have a stock. So We are saving about $500 a month.
Right. So that's about $6,000 a year. So you'll just, in terms of your goal, you're a bit far from it on $500 a month. Here's what I would recommend. And I know that, you know, some folks are going to say, are you kidding? She's paying 6.8% on these student loans. I would argue that you are earning more money because this is a question of assets here. And it's and the difference in terms of borrowing to build an asset and an investment. Your student loans were initially and really an investment in your future earnings. And you're earning good money. So though they're costing you on average around 5%, 6%, you are making something off of that, and your husband as well. So I would say if you really want to get this home within that time frame, and 2 years may be a little bit tight, but to not prepay the student loan and instead put the money in the Roth, that extra money that you have. Now, yes, you will lose some money in terms of interest on your student loan, but you'll also reach your goal of being able to buy the home the right way more quickly.
And that's exactly what we're looking for, is to make sure we do it the right way so that we're not struggling later on.
In this, the answer, the very the shorter answer to this question is, Luisa, that there is always an interest rate price to pay. However, someone like me, I would say, you know what, that 2-3% that I'm losing on the student loan in those couple of years, it's more important for me to get value and put the money towards buying that house long term.
Okay.
So crunch some of those numbers. Make sure you can stay on your goal and stay disciplined. And you can reach that goal. And then if you want to put more money towards the student loans, go ahead and do so.
Okay.
And you guys sound very disciplined and you are saving the money. So I encourage you to continue to do so, Luisa. Best of luck and thank you so much for calling in.
Thank you very much.
So make sure you send us your questions. Go to marketplacemoney.org and click on Ask Carmen. Up next, 2013 was interesting, both for Washington and our wallets. We had an overhaul of the healthcare system, changes to same-sex marriage laws, and, oh yeah, a federal government shutdown.
And this couldn't have happened, I think, at a worse time. So this was at the beginning of October, sort of leading into the holiday season. And, you know, Washington has not done very much good to help consumer confidence over these last many months.
A look back at the shutdown and other news headlines, plus maybe a sunnier look for 2014, coming up on Marketplace Money from APM. So as 2013 fades in our rearview mirrors and we bid it adios, let's chat about some of this year's biggest personal finance stories and what may lay ahead. Now, to do so, I've invited in the best and brightest around. Marketplace's DC reporter David Gura joins us. Hi, David.
Hey, Carmen. Thank you.
And Tara Siegel-Bernard is here in the studio. She writes about personal finance and consumer issues for the New York Times. Welcome, Tara.
Thank you.
And David Lazarus is the consumer columnist for the LA Times. David, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So, David Lazarus, I'm going to start with you because, of course, this huge, giant beast of a story that was and is Obamacare. This has been quite the interesting year for it. How are we ending it?
Well, we're ending it with the healthcare.gov website ostensibly up and running. We'll see about that, although the administration is reporting that the numbers of signups are increasing, and it looks like a lot of the bumps in the road are out of the way. But you're right, Carmen, healthcare, probably the single biggest pocketbook story of the year for ordinary folks, because the stakes are so large. We spend approximately $3 trillion every year on healthcare in this country, and per person, that's about twice what our colleagues in the developed world are spending overseas. There was a big story earlier this year. Steve Brill had just a terrific piece in Time magazine looking at the healthcare landscape and specifically hospital charges and how insane they are, not to put too fine a point on it. And I dwelled into that a bit myself, and I looked at drug prices, pharmacy prices, and in my reporting, I found that virtually all the major drugstore chains, and mostly CVS, were refilling people's prescriptions without their permission. CVS said, oh, no, we would never do that. But then I got my hands on emails from within the company saying that there are quotas, that there are ramifications for druggists if they don't get these things refilled. And all of this adds up to show how unlevel the playing field is and how hard it is for consumers to make informed decisions about the treatment they're seeking, about the drugs they're taking, when the entire system seems to be about reaching deeper into our pockets and walking away with as much pocket change as it can.
Yeah, and you know, what other thing do we spend money on where there are 3+ different price levels depending on who you are and coverage you have and all of these things? So it's absolutely super confusing. And one thing, David, I wanted you to also talk about is you had this personally happen to you in terms of flu shots. And I think this is really interesting because I'm going to get mine this week.
And it's about time. You're a little late to the party, Carmen.
I know, I'm so late. Yeah. I know I'm so late. Slap my hand. I know.
No wonder I've had sniffles for weeks now. You're to blame. Well, what was interesting here was I just went in for my routine flu shot. I went to a CVS in this case and was told that my insurance didn't cover it, which was a surprise because it had covered it at CVS in prior years. So I looked into it and it turns out my insurance does indeed cover it. And then I wrote about it and started hearing from lots of other people. And apparently, there was an industry-wide thing going on this flu season, if not others, where virtually every major drugstore chain seemed to be telling people that they weren't covered for flu shots, thus requiring people to pony up the approximately $30 for the shot, full value there, and allowing the drugstore to, you know, to walk away with all that extra money.
Double dipping.
Indeed. And moreover, I mean, this is another sign, if it's indeed endemic in the industry, of how the system is working against us, because you go in for a flu shot, your time is valuable. Chances are you're not going to go out and come back some other time after checking with your insurer. You're going to say, all right, here's the $30. And they seem to be counting on that. Clearly, there's a problem in the system. One thing that contributes to this is the insurers, to some extent, on the one hand, might say a flu shot is a medical treatment. On the other hand, they might say it is a drug treatment, and they can't get their signal straight. The drugstores, in turn, are having a hard time figuring out what to make of it all. And again, the consumer is caught in the middle, not knowing what's going on.
What's new in that space? What does the year ahead look like, Tara?
We've heard from a variety of readers that had really mixed experiences. Some were able to get on no problem and were happy to learn that they'd be paying less. There's also plenty of people that wrote to me over the past, you know, month or two that had said, hey, you know, I'm actually going to be paying far more than I expected. And oftentimes those were younger, healthy people who are going to have to probably pay a little bit more to offset the fact that older people, sicker people, only required to pay up to 3 times more than the general population. So there's going to be some give and take. You know, younger people may have to pay a little bit more, older, sicker people may be paying a little bit less.
David Gurr, you have written a lot about the government shutdown. We're back in Washington again with a personal finance story. You know, this really cost the economy in general, but it cost Americans too.
Yeah, absolutely. So this was probably one of the bigger stories on my beat this year. And, you know, if you look back at the last time we had government shutdowns in 95 and 96, we had estimates of how much they cost back then. They weren't the best estimates. And there it was about $1.5 billion, maybe $2.3 billion in today's dollars. The impact of this was much greater. And, you know, estimates, private estimates, were between $20 and $24 billion to the whole economy. So those 16 days when the federal government was shut down really had a significant effect just, you know, on the whole economy and on consumers as well.
And, you know, in terms of the consumer spending, a lot of folks talk about, you know, GDP and is that really a good measure of the where things are going? But, you know, it seems to have affected consumer confidence, which does at times, not necessarily directly, but maybe a correlation, affects consumer spending too. I mean, most Americans really get nervous when the parents are fighting.
Yeah, absolutely. And this couldn't have happened, I think, at a worse time. So this was at the beginning of October, sort of leading into the holiday season. And, you know, Washington has not done very much good to help consumer confidence over these last many months. This certainly was you know, a particularly low point. I think coupling with the fight here over the budget was a fight over the debt ceiling. That certainly gave consumers a lot more reason to be nervous as well. So, again, I don't think that we in Washington are doing anything good to make consumers more confident on what they're spending on.
Let's hope we get to a better point for 2014. And now, Tara, one big headline that you tracked this year and did a lot on was the Defense of Marriage Act and how it changes same-sex couples in terms of filing their taxes, because there are really some substantial changes for couples that can now get married.
Exactly. In fact, now, starting in 2013, couples are going to actually, they're going to have to file as married, either as married filed jointly or married filing separately. Mm-hmm. The demise of the Defense of Marriage Act will entitle these couples to a slew of federal benefits that their opposite sex peers took for granted, one of which may benefit them filing jointly or may not. If you are a married couple with a lower earning spouse or a stay-at-home spouse, you're actually probably going to get a nice refund. So take, for instance, one spouse, the working spouse, is earning $100,000 a year. The other spouse stays home with a child. You could save nearly $4,200 in federal taxes, which is
That's big money.
Yeah, that is big money. Of course, on the other end, if you're a higher income couple or a couple that earns about the same amount of money, just because of the way the tax brackets line up, you could be paying far more. So you really have to run the numbers to see where you're going to come out. But TurboTax actually has a new calculator that will help you do that. And the reason why you want to check in with such a calculator or with your accountant is because you can refile your tax returns for the past 3 years. So if you're that, you know, couple making $100,000 entitled to a $4,200 return times three, that's significant savings.
That's buku bucks.
Yeah, yeah. So for 2010, 11, and 12, generally speaking, you can refile.
Retro.
Exactly.
And what about the financial services industry? You know, I mean, there's a lot of knowledge now about who the financial industry's providers are in terms of demographic, mm-hmm. and the new kind of rising demographic. So people of color, women as, you know, household, not only earners, but they manage the money. And now we have couples who can get married, all of a sudden this is a whole new industry in and of itself.
Right. But actually their situation should get easier to manage. There were a lot of financial planners that specialize in same-sex couples because there are so many, you know, specific rules depending on where you live. Do you live in a marriage state? Do you have children? Yeah. Do you live in a non-marriage state? So there are, you know, a lot of financial planners that do, and even now a lot of the firms that cater to high net worth folks of the world, Northern Trusts and whatnot, have special units that cater to these folks.
That's great. And you know what? Here's one favorite of mine that I'd love to talk about with you guys. The CFPB, the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau. Listen, this is the first year that they're all together. They've got someone in charge. But so how have they been doing this year? I mean, they seem to be doing something, but how effective have they been this year?
Well, it seems please. As though they've spent quite a bit of their time this year not just getting the enforcement thing rolling, but also marking territory, you know, mm-hmm. Marking the trees in the forest to lay
That's
down.
That's a great image.
Thank you very much. It is Washington, and so I want to be apropos.
Fitting.
They're trying to basically establish the territory that they're going to be covering, and it is a wider purview than might have been imagined. I mean, they've been gradually going after other types of lenders, other types of financial institutions, other types of loans, and making it clear that they are taking their mandate of consumer financial protection very seriously. And I think it's to Richard Cordray's credit, now that he's in the captain's seat, that they are being so assertive in making it clear to all concerned that there's a new sheriff in town.
David Gore, what's your take on effectiveness here?
Yeah, I mean, I think that they're flexing their independence pretty well. And, you know, I was struck back in September, we had one of these J.P. Morgan settlements that they were party to. And that was, you know, demanding a refund of an estimated $300-something million to millions of customers that Chase had sort of engaged in malfeasance with. I think they'd charged cardholders for services that they weren't, in fact, getting. So, I agree with the other David that they're not just doing something, they're doing some things and really doing a whole lot from my vantage here.
Tara, let me ask you, you know, there was one big giant boo-boo in the CARD Act that the CFPB kind of fiddled with, which was the whole stay-at-home spouse, you know, that you couldn't get a credit card if you didn't have earned income.
Right.
So they've made some changes there, but that didn't give me a lot of confidence necessarily that the folks that are making these regulations that are supposedly protecting consumers actually know how American households are run, because if you don't understand that someone who is earning the money and you have a stay-at-home spouse, that having access to credit is basically a lifeline for many people.
Absolutely. I'm actually really interested to see how the CFPB weighs in on the big credit reporting bureaus, because up until now, they really haven't been, you know, maybe lightly regulated by the FTC, if you could call it that, the Federal Trade Commission, but now they fall under their purview. So it's going to be really interesting, because our credit reports are our lifelines to just about everything these days.
Yeah, I mean, if you know how these credit reports really work, and if you're like us and you're digging in all this nerdy stuff, I actually live in complete and utter fear of what happens, because we talk to, a lot of us talk to and hear from folks who have their identity stolen or such, and they have to work directly with the credit reporting bureaus. It can be a nightmare.
Oh, absolutely. You're expected to send everything in electronically, and you're just waiting, and it's difficult just to find a 1-800 number to call to get a live person, and in most cases, you cannot. So it will be really interesting to see.
So for folks who are listening, if you live in fear, go to FTC.gov. They do have a whole like list that you can go through of the 1, 2, 3, 4, what to do if this happens to you. And I would just want to round it up with one last quick topic, if I can get your feedback on it. David Lazarus, I'll start with you. Income inequality. We are really talking about this. This is a pocketbook issue, because we really are being limited in terms of having enough money to pay for everything.
Oh, it's a huge issue. And happily, Robert Reich called attention to it earlier this year with a really terrific documentary that highlights this. I mean, the haves have more than ever, and the have-nots are just scraping by with less and less. And we're seeing, as the economy is recovering, that there really isn't any sort of more equitable distribution of the nation's wealth. And that's not to be flying the Marxist-Leninist banner. That's just to simply say that if working stiffs don't have enough money to go out and buy things, then the haves at some point are going to find that the income isn't rolling upward in their direction like it used to be. So this is a major problem with enormous economic ramifications.
David Gura, help us out. You're in D.C. You got your ear to the ground. Give us some good news.
Yeah, I wish I could. I mean,
maybe.
I think that this, I think this is continuing to percolate. But yeah, David says go out and buy things. I mean, we got this report earlier this month from Harvard about just how much people are paying for rent. And, you know, that's going to continue hitting folks who are on the, let's say, the left end of that spectrum. So, I think I'm hearing more and more about income inequality here in Washington. And I can only hope that as 2014 goes along, it's going to come up more and more.
Tara, what do you think? Are things going to get better? Are we going to have some budging when it comes to income?
Well, you know, the only thing we can control is what we spend.
Right.
So that's, you know, people are just going to continue to focus on that. And that probably won't help the economy very much if we don't have enough to spend to keep it going. But that's, you know, everybody's concerned about the economy, but it starts at home. People are concerned about their own personal economies.
So. Exactly. That's where it is. And that's where the struggle is. Well, you know, guys, I hope that 14 is a much luckier number for the future. Tara Siegel-Bernard is a consumer issues reporter with the New York Times. David Lazarus is the LA Times consumer columnist. And marketplace reporter David Gura is based in D.C. Thank you all so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, you know, we love to hear from you. One of my fave forms of communique, your recordings on our website at marketplacemoney.org, like this gentleman with a money question.
Hi, my name is Andrew. I'm calling from Ann Arbor, Michigan, and I'm calling with a mortgage question. My fiance and I recently closed on a home, and after the closing, we received a mail from a third-party company indicating that we could reduce the total amount that we paid on our loan by paying every other week instead of monthly. I initially thought that the reason that this worked was that by paying more frequently, you reduced the total interest that you paid. After reading the fine print, however, I realized that the way that you pay less money over time is you're essentially making one extra or one half payment per year. Although this doesn't save any money because you could simply put more payment towards the principal in each of your monthly checks, it did get me thinking if there were any other ways of changing the frequency of payment that would over time reduce the total amount on the mortgage.
Sure, Andrew. there are many different ways that you can prepay your mortgage. You could put an extra payment in every year at the end of the year. You could also put in more monthly. But here's what you need to be careful of. Every mortgage lender is different. They have different policies in terms of prepaying and also putting payments towards principal as opposed to interest. So make sure you pick up the phone. Talk to your mortgage lender. Ask about any prepayment penalties. Ask what is the best way to put more money towards the mortgage without any fees at all. Now, here's the thing I have to ask you, Andrew. Why are you prepaying your mortgage? What's your interest rate? How's the rest of your savings going? Though putting an extra payment could reduce how much interest you pay overall, is that the best investment of your money? Could your money do better elsewhere? For example, in a retirement account? Or do you have emergency savings? Is that all shored up? You want to make sure in retirement that you are not house rich, cash poor. So balance prepaying a mortgage with making sure that you're covered and you're saving enough every place else. Thank you so much, Andrew. And if you have a question for me, make sure you click on that Ask Carmen button at marketplacemoney.org and send me a voicemail.
Please leave a message after the tone.
Next, it may be time for a breakup.
This financial planner is someone that I feel very comfortable with. I like him a lot. I feel that he's very honest and straightforward, and he gives us good advice.
But the question is he worth it? A conversation about the give and take in managing your money, plus end-of-the-year tips, all next on Marketplace Money from APM. Breaking up, it's hard to do. Let's go back to the phones.
Carmen, what's going on?
I'm here for you. Corey and his wife are in their mid-50s. They live in Minneapolis, and they've been going to a financial planner for 15 years. So far, so good. Now, Corey's got a hefty, healthy portfolio. But there is one cost that Corey's concerned about, and this is a cost that we should all be concerned about, no matter how big or how small our balance. Corey, talk to me.
Well, mostly I wonder about the value. This financial planner is someone that I feel very comfortable with. I like him a lot. I feel that he's very honest and straightforward, and he gives us good advice. He set up our accounts in 2006 when we received a rather large inheritance. And moved it from the bank where they had it invested in the bank's proprietary mutual funds over to what, you know, we considered to be better funds, funds that had a better track record. And everything's been fine. It's just kind of sitting there. We meet with him every 6 to 9 months and go over things and maybe make some minor adjustments. But the fact is we're paying 1% of the value of the fund, which is a significant amount of money. I just have a feeling that if we were given a bill, an invoice for, you know, the year's services, that my wife and I would look at it and say, wow, that's a lot of money. So I don't know now if I can take over the account and just do this on my own with some, you know, occasional advice from financial planners, or if I should really stick with him because he's set up the fund and that's just the way things work.
Well, but Corey, you've been satisfied pretty much with how he's been managing the money and where the money is. Are you happy with that?
Yes, I am. You know, it's sitting there just waiting for us. We're in our mid-50s. It's mostly retirement money. We want it to just be stable. You know, we're paying anywhere from $8,000 to $10,000 a year for his services. And the question is, are we really getting that much out of it to pay that amount of money?
Well, now you mentioned it's just sitting there. So, have you seen any movement, or have you guys made any changes over the years? Every 6 months, you meet with him. Do things change?
We change things a little bit if he feels that certain kinds of investments are going to do a little better. But we're really talking about a very small percentage.
Well, I have to tell you something, Corey. It's funny because you mentioned, okay, I'm paying for this service, but is he actually really doing something and earning that money? There was a study done by the school that I'm a professor at NYU Poly about the value of financial advisors. And what the study found was, and you might find this interesting, is that the value of a good financial planner or advisor is not necessarily what they put you into, but what they stop you from doing. So the biggest benefit that the study found was that a financial planner or advisor, a good one, will stop you from making a move that will cost you down the road. Now, the question to you is, if you were to manage this money yourself, how much confidence do you have in having basically the same performance or better performance than what your financial planner is doing for you now?
Well, I don't have a whole lot of confidence in myself, but I I would certainly go and talk to financial planners, probably, you know, different ones over the years, to get ideas about any changes that we should make or what's happening. I'm frustrated because I feel totally helpless because the market seems to control everything. And I have no control over the market.
Right.
You know, lately, the market has been doing pretty well. So our value has increased. Of course, in 2008, the market went down about 35%, and so did the value of all of our investments.
And I can hear the frustration. It is frustrating, and it's hard to see. However, what you can control is where you choose to put your money. Because though the market overall may have gone down that much or gone up that much, if you were to put your money in less risky places, you would have a lot less fluctuation in value. So what do you think, Corey, about talking with your planner about this? Is this about he's not doing enough for you, maybe, or that you really want some more hands-on control over where your money is?
No, I don't want any more hands-on, and I don't have any problem with what he's done and what he's doing for us. I just feel that the price tag is awfully high. And also that the fees are hidden. You know, we don't get a bill. It's just discreetly deducted from the account. Mm-hmm. And in the, 25-page statement that we get every month, somewhere in there, the administrative fees are listed.
And you're also probably paying fees on the mutual funds themselves.
Well, no, I'm not, because we pay the 1% of the value, and there are no other fees.
Here's what I'd ask you is to kind of think of the scenario of what would happen if that money then became under your control, not only with the 1% being gone, but then where would that money go and how much would it cost you? Because, of course, you can go with the low-cost providers like Fidelity and Vanguard, where the expenses in terms of the cost of your investments is really low, anywhere from like 0.2, you know, to 0.5. But would you be losing some of that security of having somebody who can handle an event? So, for example, you mentioned 2008, and you've been with this person for 15 years. Was he very useful during that time when you felt, wow, I'm losing all this money?
No, I don't think he was especially helpful. It was just reassuring to know that everybody was in the same boat.
Yes, I was there with you, Corey. We all were there with you.
Yeah, and he was too. He said his personal accounts are taking the same hit as everybody else because the market is just plummeted.
Well, I'll tell you, that 1%, the reason why advisors who charge fees this way do is because there is some implicit idea that, okay, if I build and grow your money, I make more money. So that's why it's that way. But you mentioned, Corey, about that you would talk to other financial planners. Would you mean that you would speak with like an hourly planner and just pay an hourly fee?
Correct.
That's actually a really good option. You know, you may not need the service. You've been with him for a very long time. As to how you would do this is, you know, you would have to talk and say, we really just don't feel that this fee is affordable for us right now, and we would like to move our funds. I would ask you to ask him if, rather than losing you completely, maybe you can say, can we take our money, we're going to handle the money, but meet with you twice a year and pay you a flat rate? That may be something that they would be willing to do, but sometimes the way they're set up in terms of regulation, they can or can't do that. But it's definitely worth asking.
Oh, that's a good idea. I will go to him. I've been thinking about going to him, but I rather avoid confrontation. So far, I haven't really brought up the subject yet.
Well, one of the things is, and you mentioned in your question is, you know, do you stay with him just as a reward because he's, you know, he's helped you? You know, think about this as a service just like any other service in your life. When you're paying somebody and you're paying mm-hmm. them to do something for you and you're just not satisfied at that point, you absolutely have the right, and that's the cost of business, to say, thank you so much for years of service. We really feel like we want to take this over right now because the expenses are too high. Can you, you know, let's get that in motion in the next 30 days. Have a time limit. Say, you know, you want by this date to have the money rolled over to you. And then ask about the ability to sit, you know, once or twice a year for an hourly fee, if possible. And if not, then you would go and find somebody who could do that with you.
Sounds like good advice. I appreciate your comments very much.
Thank you so much, Corey, for joining us today.
You bet. Thank you.
And if you are looking for a financial planner, a fee-based financial planner, you can head over for a search at fpanet.org for free. And if you have a question, make sure you head over to marketplacemoney.org and click on Ask Carmen. Resolutions are hard, but they can be easier, especially if you put systems into place that fit you and how you tend to behave. Now, even better, hold yourself accountable to others. So here's some inspiration for your money resolutions for the new year. Someone who found success on many levels in 2013.
Hi, my name is Joe Udo. I'm 40 years old, and I am a stay-at-home dad and full-time blogger. When I have a goal, I usually just keep pushing to make it work. Usually I don't make goals that are out of reach, so usually I think I can do it. I'm a little bit methodical. For the year 2013, we had a pretty big change because it would be the first full year where I don't have a full-time job. So there are some uncertainty about our income. The good thing is that my wife is still working and she likes her job, so we were, you know, able to have that stability there. The resolution that I'm most proud of this year is to contribute $10,000 to our kids' 529 account. This one was a little bit difficult. $10,000 is a lot of money, and you never know if the kid is going to college. We do think about our kids' higher education quite often, actually. A lot of people depend on their kid to get student loans instead, but we don't really want to do that. My parents helped pay for my college education, and my wife also got a lot of help from her parents. So that's kind of our inheritance. For 2014, I think we'll set up an automatic deduction so we can take advantage of dollar cost averaging. And because, you know, putting $10,000 at once, you never know if the market is going up or down. To meet our financial goals, we do have to make some sacrifice. We mostly cook at home. We only have one car that we share instead of a car each, like most families. Blogging about financial goal is really helpful because I have my readers who are keeping track of my financial goals too, as well as myself. So if I fail, I'm not just disappointing myself, I'm also disappointing my readers.
Joe Udo authors the blog retireby40.org. You can find a link to it and a list of the money resolutions Joe kept this year at our website, marketplacemoney.org. And while you're there, make sure to let us know your resolutions for the new year. Let's make them happen. Along with New Year resolutions and gift returns, here's another holiday rite of passage, end of year tax planning. Wait, don't go away, because what you do now can make a big difference in your tax bill. Barry Glassman joins us. He's a certified financial planner. Barry, thanks for being here.
Sure, my pleasure.
we hear taxes this time of year, we're all very busy, you know, so it's hard to think about something so concrete and heavy as taxes. But there are still opportunities to not only make sure you save before the end of the year on your taxes and the tax bill for 2013, but to help you plan for next year, right?
Exactly. And here's the great news this year. For the first time in a long time, we know what's likely to be the tax brackets and the rules for next year. The past couple of years, there have been rules expiring and tax brackets expiring and all kinds of different things. This year's kind of easier due to just less congressional noise.
Ah, there's one for the books. The less congressional noise, because we've been hearing a lot of noise out there. But there are some things that for, you know, regular folks that they're doing automatically this time of year that can help save. And one of them is, you know, a quarter of all charitable contributions happen during the winter holidays. So folks still have time to get that deduction right now, right?
Exactly. While a lot of us give to great philanthropic organizations because we want to do good, we also need to keep in mind that there's a tax benefit as well. Taxpayers need to know that there's an advantage to donating appreciated securities. So let's say you bought a stock or a mutual fund a few years ago during the downturn, and it's appreciated substantially. If you sold today, you'd realize a capital gain. But if you donate that stock or mutual fund to the charity, you get the full market value of the donation, and the charity gets to sell it and not pay the tax.
There you go. That's something for you. Now, speaking of assets, retirement account contributions. This is a big one, and not only for folks who are full-time and have, you know, access to employer-sponsored benefits, but also folks who work for themselves, right?
There are two things that people should look at outside of the basics. Number one is for everyone listening who's turning 50 next year, they should consider the fact that they can contribute a bit more with catch-up contributions. Congress put this in place a number of years ago for those people who are mature enough to handle the extra $5,500 of contributions. They can go ahead and put that in place. That won't take place automatically in their 401ks and things. They need to elect to increase their contributions. For those people who are self-employed and have SEPs, they may want to switch to an individual K. Some people call it a solo K. Some people call it a uni K. But basically, it's a personal 401k plan. And this is for people who are self-employed. And what they can do is likely save about what they were saving in a SEP, likely more, and they have the opportunity for the catch-up contribution. There's a great website called individualk.com. You visit there and you can plug in your income and it'll calculate individual K, SEP, simple, all the various kinds of plans.
Got it. And Barry, if somebody needs to cash out an investment, let's say, this year, you know, capital gains is still there and it is still a tax. So how can you minimize that tax bite?
I'm not a believer in making investment decisions based on taxes alone. So if it makes sense to move out of an investment and take a gain, take the gain. Now, if investors have losses or losers in their portfolio and it makes sense to sell before year end, those losses can help offset the capital gains that were realized either earlier in the year or at year end.
And Barry, I have one more question that I hear a lot from folks. When should somebody use a tax professional?
My advice is if you need somebody just to plug it in and spit out a return, meaning an actual tax preparer, the software is fantastic. If you need somebody to strategize and think, use a tax professional. A lot of times it just makes sense to think through, hey, I'm in a low tax bracket this year and I'm going to be in a higher one next year. Any chance I might do something this year like, I don't know, convert part of my IRA to a Roth? What would that do? Hire a tax professional once you're ready to have somebody think and strategize and project.
Strategy when it comes to tax time is key. Barry Glassman is the president of Glassman Wealth Services. Barry, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks. It was my pleasure.
So be sure to check out marketplacemoney.org for a roundup of more tax tips for the end of the year. And we love hearing from you, especially on Twitter. So tweet us your questions about taxes or any other tips you're looking out for at Live Money. That's Marketplace Money for this week. Next week, we're going to begin a year-long series following you and the goals for your money in 2014. Marketplace Money is produced by Nancy Fargali, Raghu Manavalan, Candice Manriquez, and Lindsay Foster Thomas. Bill Lanz is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. I'm Carmen Wong-Ulrich. Now remember to always check with your financial pro before you make any big money decisions. Thanks for listening, and let's talk soon.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again.
This is APM.